Well, it should have something to do with its history and origin. And the best place to learn about Iranian carpet and its fascinating history is the Carpet Museum of Tehran. This museum is an excellent source of research about carpets for all culture and art lovers. So, accompany me in our today's tour. Iranian carpet, as an old handicraft, has universal reputation. The Iranian Pazirik carpet is the oldest carpet discovered in the world. This carpet dates back to the year 400 BC. Researchers believe this carpet most probably belongs to the Achaemenid era. Production of Iranian handmade carpets reached its peak during the Safavid era. This art started booming during Fatali Shah of Qajar and further during Nasiruddin Shah of Qajar dynasty, and Iran became the biggest exporter of handmade carpet in the world. The Carpet Museum of Tehran represents a collection of the most noble and invaluable hand-woven carpets dating back to 9th Hijri calendar year to the present time. The museum's collection includes so many rare rugs and beautiful carpets, including carpets from the country's most famous weaving centers. At the museum's founding, there was a limited selection of carpets, but over the years, that number has increased greatly. The museum's library contains thousands of books in multiple languages, including Farsi, English, German, French, and Arabic. These books are a collection of some of the most important and rare publications and research about Iranian carpets available. Furthermore, the collection also includes cultural books on religion, art, and literature. They're available to researchers, students, and art lovers alike. And the adjacent bookstore has pieces available for purchase. Thank you. I get off here. I take a little walk to reach the Lale Park. The museum is located on the northern part of the park. Oh, here it is. The first thing you have to notice is the museum building itself. If you look closely, you can see that this building looks like a giant carpet weaving loom. The first floor of the museum holds beautiful permanent carpet collection exhibits. The museum's second floor, however, is reserved for seasonal or temporary exhibits. Let me enter the museum. Oh, in this interesting museum, you will see loads of different types of Iranian carpet. Look at the pattern. Each one is telling you its very own unique story in the shape of knots, threads, and colors. It's not that strange to say carpets are kind of pious to Iranian people. You know, walking on them with shoes on is normally forbidden in every Iranian house. In Iran, carpet weaving is regarded not so much as an occupation, but rather as an art. As I can see, these carpets have so much to tell you about Iran's history, culture, and art. Here's a fantastic treasury where you will find carpets from different times and all over Iran, from well-designed Isfahan carpets to lovely handmade carpets of Qashqai nomads. Oh, just look at the colors. They are speaking with you. Oh, the design. They are breathtaking. I wish you were here. You have to see them by your own eyes.
You can also make a stop at the museum's tea shop after a long day of browsing carpets and history. A cup of Iranian tea can be so relaxing. I'll take one at this tea shop, but I promise I won't spill it over the floor.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian has paid a two-day visit to Saudi Arabia. On Friday, Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman welcomed Emir Abdullahian to the city of Jeddah. It was the first time a senior Iranian official met with the Saudi Crown Prince. In their meeting, both officials reviewed bilateral ties and explored future opportunities for cooperation between Tehran and Riyadh. They also discussed the latest international and regional developments. Amir Abdullahian reiterated Iran's determination to improve relations with the countries in the region, particularly Saudi Arabia. He said Iran and Saudi Arabia play a leading role in the region and the Muslim world. He underscored the need to boost dialogue as well as development-oriented ties as the path to success in the region. The Saudi Crown Prince, for his part, extended his own and Saudi King's greetings to Iran's leader Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei and President Ebrahim Raisi. Bin Salman said Saudi Arabia views the partnership with Iran as strategic. He reiterated Riyadh's invitation to the Iranian president to travel to Saudi Arabia. Before meeting bin Salman, the top Iranian diplomat held talks with his Saudi counterpart Faisal bin Farhan in the capital Riyadh on Thursday. In a joint press conference, Amir Abdullahian said relations between the two countries are on the right track and progressing. Meanwhile, bin Farhan confirmed that the Saudi embassy in Tehran had resumed operations, which he described as another step in the development of relations between the two countries. The Saudi consulate in the northeastern city of Mashhad restarted its activities as well. At the end of his trip, the top Iranian diplomat said he found the Saudi authorities with a different approach than in the past, adding that the Saudis are willing to open a new chapter in bilateral relations. In a social media post, the Iranian foreign minister hailed the discussions as frank, beneficial, and productive. Amir Abdullahian's visit to Saudi Arabia was significant as it was the first time the top Iranian diplomat visited the kingdom since the signing of a Chinese brokered deal between Tehran and Riyadh to restore ties in March. Tehran and Riyadh severed ties in 2016 after protests broke out in Iran over Riyadh's execution of senior cleric Nimr al-Nimr. The administration of President Ebrahim Raisi has focused on the expansion of ties with neighboring and regional states, a policy which will, among other things, help Tehran benefit from the capacities of other countries. The latest thawing of relations between Iran and Saudi Arabia, two prominent countries on either sides of the Persian Gulf, is in line with this policy of President Raisi's administration. The re-establishment of diplomatic relations between the two heavyweights has become a source of concern for Israel and the West over the past months as the restoration of diplomatic relations between Tehran and Riyadh grew more serious. Arab countries have notably shifted their attitudes to Iran, demonstrating a clear interest in deepening their relations with Tehran. And at the same time, this development has raised concerns among Israel and its Western allies. Furthermore, an additional cause for their apprehension lies in the potential collaboration between Iran and Saudi Arabia in addressing the Palestinian issue, which poses a threat to Israel's political influence and propaganda efforts. Another source of worry pertains to economic and energy matters. Iran holds one of the world's largest reserves of natural gas, while Saudi Arabia is the leading oil producer. Consequently, Tehran and Riyadh could potentially play a joint role in the energy sector in the near future, the outcomes of which remain unclear for Western countries. In the realm of international affairs, embassy activities are considered customary, and having an embassy alone does not necessarily reflect the quality of relations between two nations. However, the Saudi invitation to Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi to visit the kingdom demonstrates Riyadh's keenness to enhance relations with Tehran.
The United Nations has warned that millions of people across Sudan are running out of food and are on the brink of famine as the situation in the war-torn northeast African country is spiraling out of control. The international body has said the ongoing armed conflict has impeded agricultural activities, causing millions of people to face acute food insecurity. Many people are also dying due to lack of healthcare. Time is running out for farmers to plant the crops that will feed them and their neighbors. The situation is spiraling out of control.
recipients, looting humanitarian supplies, targeting aid workers and hospitals, or blocking aid, things we have seen throughout those 4 months, may amount to war crimes and crimes against humanity.
According to the UN, the war has caused over 1 million people to cross from Sudan into neighboring countries, many already struggling with the impact of conflicts or economic crises. Those displaced within Sudan are estimated to number over 3.4 million people. Furthermore, more than 6 million people in Sudan are one step away from famine. More than 14 million children need humanitarian aid. The statement comes as 4 months of a power struggle between Sudan's army and the paramilitary rapid support forces has killed nearly 4,000 people. The conflict erupted on April 15th over tensions linked to a planned transition to civilian rule, plunging the country into violence. UN officials also say reports of sexual assaults have increased in the country.
Just to give you an idea, we've seen an increase of more than 900% in the conflict areas of gender-based violence. 900%. Those women are incredibly at risk, and we really do need the funding and the access to those areas to be able to provide services for them.
Reports from our protection and field teams in neighboring Chad, Central African Republic, Egypt, and South Sudan have also described the horrific ordeals faced by women and girls in Sudan. Shocking incidents of sexual violence, including rape, sexual assault, sexual exploitation, and physical violence, have been reported by women and girls who have fled the conflict.
Fighting in Sudan broke out back in April over a power struggle between two rival generals, Army Chief Abdel Fattah al-Burhan and former deputy Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo.
Once we put on these khakis, we have no other path. We do not get startled or afraid. And even if every one of us is dead, we will not be frightened or back away.
The clashes initially broke out in Khartoum and later spread to Darfur. The roots of the crisis dates to several years ago. In 2019, a coup d'etat ousted the country's longtime ruler, Omar al-Bashir, in the context of massive civil disobedience. An interim joint civilian military unity government headed by Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok was established. However, in October 2021, the military seized power in a coup which was led by the Sudanese Armed Forces leader Abdel Fattah al-Burhan and rapid support forces led by Hamdan Dagalo. Rapid support forces evolved from so-called Janjaweed militias which fought in a conflict in the 2000s in the Darfur region. Over time, the militia grew. It was made into the RSF in 2013 and its forces were used as border guards in particular. In 2017, a law legitimizing the RSF as an independent security force was passed. There are also indications that Bashir-era loyalists in the army feared that a new political agreement would significantly harm their economic and political power. Many of these loyalists blame RSF leader Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo for turning on al-Bashir in 2019. Despite peace efforts, fighting continued unabated in the African country, with the army and the RSF trading blame over truce violations. In May, the two warring sides agreed to send negotiating teams to Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, to start talks brokered by Riyadh and Washington. At least 16 ceasefire agreements followed, with each of them collapsing.
The U.S. military has decided to send F-16 fighter planes to Ukraine from Denmark and the Netherlands as soon as the training of Ukrainian pilots is completed. A U.S. official said on Thursday Washington has assured both countries that it will expedite approval of transfer requests for F-16s to go to Ukraine when their pilots are trained. The U.S. must approve the transfer of F-16s from its allies to Ukraine. A coalition of 11 countries was due to start training Ukrainian pilots to fly fighter jets this month in Denmark.
as you know, Denmark and the Netherlands are taking the lead on training. We have, and the president has given the green light to allow and support the training to move forward, but I just don't have any further updates at this time when it comes to specific pilots being trained.
The thing is that it is a very strong weapon system. It's a very strong capability, but it's not going to be available anytime soon. President Zelensky, of course, knows that.
U.S. officials have privately said that the F-16 fighter jets would be no game changer when they arrive, given Russia's air defense systems and its air superiority, that the request would be approved. The U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken sent letters to his Danish and Dutch counterparts, assuring them that the request would be approved. He said the approval of the request would allow Ukraine to take full advantage of its new capabilities as soon as the first set of pilots complete their training.
Officials in Kiev have repeatedly requested the F-16s. Some NATO states have agreed to instruct Ukrainian pilots, but it remains unclear when the first transfer could occur. U.S. President Joe Biden endorsing training programs for Ukrainian pilots on F-16s in May, but no timing for the supply of the warplanes has been declared yet. According to a recent report in the Washington Post, the initial batch of Ukrainian pilots trained on F-16 will not be ready until after the summer of 2024, with only six airmen set to complete the first round of instructions.
Flying-wise, well, technically, I mean, if you're a pilot, this is also just an airplane. But to fly a fighter jet and to transition to an F-16, which for them would mean, like, different technology, different design concepts.
Russia has repeatedly warned that the influx of Western weapons and military equipment only prolongs the conflict and increases the risk of military confrontation with NATO. Moscow has said Western powers would run, quote, colossal risks if they decided to supply the F-16. Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has said that Russia would consider the aircraft a nuclear threat due to its ability to carry atomic weapons.
Yes, look, that's right. I mean, the pro-war people keep saying, look, it's up to Ukraine to decide when to negotiate. But the reality is the U.S. is funding practically 100% of this war, and the Allies are providing 100% of the munitions. So at any time they could say, look, you know, enough's enough. We're not going to do this anymore. And then, of course, Ukraine would have to negotiate.
Ukraine says its troops have recaptured a village from Russian forces in the southeastern Donetsk region. Ukraine's deputy defense minister said forces have secured their position by erecting defensive lines on the outskirts of the village. There was no immediate response to the Ukrainian claim from Moscow. Separately, Russian drones inflicted damage upon grain facilities at Danube port in the southern region of Odessa. Ukraine has also launched a number of cross-border drone attacks inside of Russia. Meanwhile, NATO member Poland has held its biggest military parade since the Cold War in an event that marked victory over Soviet forces in 1920. Warsaw showcased the country's state-of-the-art weaponry as the war was raging in neighboring Ukraine. Poland's army has more than 175,000 troops, an increase from approximately 100,000 8 years ago.
There are existing risks associated with the militarization of Poland, which has become the main instrument of the United States' anti-Russian policy. Warsaw announced the intention to build, according to the Poles, the most powerful army on the continent.
Poland has also expressed concern about the movement of Wagner forces in Belarus towards the Polish border. The Polish Prime Minister has said, "We have information that more than 100 Wagner mercenaries have advanced towards the Suwalki Gap, not far from Grodno in Belarus. Grodno is located in the west of Belarus, about 15 kilometers from its border with NATO members Poland and Lithuania. The Suwalki Gap is a narrow strategic land corridor on their territory between Belarus and Russia's Baltic exclave of Kaliningrad. Poland is worried about its security with Russian ally Belarus and Ukraine on its eastern border.
Anti-French sentiment runs high in Niger as thousands of people have rallied near a French military base on the outskirts of the capital, Niamey, to call for the withdrawal of the country's forces. Protesters shouted "Down with France" and "Down with ECOWAS" as they surrounded the base. The demonstrators argue that the West African regional bloc is not independent and is being manipulated by France. ECOWAS has given the green light for a military intervention in Niger after it approved the deployment of a standby force as part of its effort to remove Niger military rulers following last month's coup and reinstate deposed pro-Western leader Mohamed Bazoum. The Ivory Coast president says heads of state of the 15-nation bloc have agreed that the operation should start as soon as possible. The president said his country will provide a maximum of 1,100 troops alongside soldiers from Nigeria and Benin. He said other member countries will join them later. France has thrown its full backing to all the conclusions of the West African leaders who met in Nigerian capital Abuja to make the necessary arrangements. The United States has also voiced support for efforts of ECOWAS on Niger.
As significantly, ECOWAS, the organization that brings together West African countries, is playing a lead role in making clear the imperative of the return to constitutional order, and we very much support ECOWAS's leadership and work on this.
The support for ECOWAS efforts come as a deadline set by the regional bloc for Bazoum to be reinstated on August 6th was ignored by Nigerian junta. The junta has moved one step further and announced a new government there. The developments in Niger come nearly 3 weeks after soldiers belonging to the country's presidential guard blockaded access to President Bazoum's residence in Niamey and arrested him. Shortly after the storming of the president's residence, the army led by General Abdurrahman Tiani took control of the country's political leadership there. The idea of a military intervention in Niger comes as many people across the West African nation are opposed to foreign meddling in their internal political affairs.
Today they're in front of our army. It's no longer that they're in front of us. That's to say, if they're thinking of attacking the military, they will first have to attack us, the people of Niger.
But unlike Nigerians, Western countries, namely France and the United States, are pushing for a military intervention there. After all, there are certain facts that lie within their interest, which a change in Nigerian political leadership can hamper all those benefits. In the case of France, the country has domination over Niger's economy. That's why Paris has been seeking a military solution to the crisis in Niger since the very first day of the outbreak of the coup there. One significant factor is Niger's vast uranium reserves. The country supplies around 5% of the world's uranium and is a leading supplier of that chemical element to the European Union. The French government is almost entirely dependent on Niger, as some 25% of Niger's uranium production goes to France. Using that uranium to produce electricity, Paris has become a large exporter of power that goes to countries like Germany and other European nations. The electricity export of that amount makes French huge profits, which make it hard for Paris to admit new political changes in Niger. In the case of the United States, Washington is seeing a growing tendency toward Russia among people in West African nations, including Niger, Burkina Faso, and Mali, and that is why, seeing its political interests in tatters, it is pushing for a military intervention in Niger to reinstate pro-West former President Bazoum. With ECOWAS being under the direct influence of Western powers, an actual military intervention in Niger is not unthinkable, despite repeated warnings from Russia that any such move would destabilize the whole region. But apart from that, what matters most of all is that Niger belongs to Nigerians, and they are the ones who should decide their own fate. Given all the anti-Western hatred among the people of Niger and other West African nations, it seems that it is for the Western countries to stop meddling in the affairs of those nations and let people choose their own political path.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
اقرأ بسم ربك الذي خلق.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. يا أيها المزمل قم الليل إلا قليلا نصفه
أو انقص منه قليلا أو زد عليه ورتل القرآن ترتيلا.
قد دعوتك ربي بقرآني جنبني حراني.
Let's recite the Quran.
ناجيتك أرجو غفرانك يا من ينجينا إحسان ودعوتك ربي بقرآني.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم. السلام عليكم brothers and sisters, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to Let's Recite the Quran Kareem, a series of Quranic sessions and practical tajweed rules, step by step, verse by verse. Inshallah, we're here with you. And I really welcome you all. Thanks for joining IRIB English Radio. Fawad Haider, Salam, Hassan, Hussein, and Ali Nasir, welcome, brothers. Is everyone fine?
Alhamdulillah.
Alhamdulillah. So, inshallah, let's go and start our class. Inshallah, today we'll talk about Ayah 102 and 103 of Surah Ali Imran on page 60. Three, right?
Yes.
Let's everyone listen to the recitation.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Ya ayyuhalladhina amanu ittaqullaha haqqa tuqatih wa la tamutunna illa wa antum muslimun. واعتصموا بحبل الله جميعا ولا تفرقوا واذكروا نعمة الله عليكم إذ كنتم أعداء فألف بين قلوبكم فأصبحتم بنعمته إخوانا وكنتم على شفا حفرة من النار فأنقذكم منها كذلك يبين الله لكم آياته لعلكم تهتدون.
Nice recitation, Alhamdulillah, amazing. Allah bless the reciter, inshallah. So, on Ayah 102, Allah Almighty says, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم يا أيها الذين آمنوا اتقوا الله حق تقاته ولا تموتن إلا وأنتم مسلمون واعتصموا بحبل الله جميعا ولا تفرقوا واذكروا نعمة الله عليكم إذ كنتم أعداء فألف بين قلوبكم فأصبحتم بنعمته إخوانا وكنتم على شفا حفرة من النار فأنقذكم منها كذلك يبين الله لكم آياته لعلكم تهتدون. So, Allah Almighty says in Ayah 102, Hassan, Hussein, Ali Nasir, Fawad, Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu. You are also, alhamdulillah, amongst the people of believers. O you who have faith. Allah Almighty talks to all of us. Okay? Fawad, Hassan, Hussein, Ali Nasir, me, brothers here, those who listen to us, brothers and sisters, inshallah, we are amongst the believers. So Allah Almighty talks to us. Fawad, what does Allah Almighty say? Ittaqullah. Ittaqullah. Okay? Allah yes. Almighty says, be wary of Allah. Means be pious. Okay? Yes. Practice taqwa. حق تقاته. Okay, اتقوا الله حق تقاته. Be wary of Allah with the wariness due to Him. Okay, ولا تموتن. It means be perform taqwa, practice taqwa, taqwa of Allah the way He deserves. ولا تموتن and do not die. Fawad Hassan Hussein Ali Nasir. Do not die. إلا وأنتم مسلمون and do not die except as Muslims. This was what Prophet Yaqub عليه السلام and Prophet Ibrahim عليه السلام actually told his children, okay, that ولا تموتن إن الله اصطفى لكم الدين فلا تموتن إلا وأنتم مسلمون. I think that was the ayah that in Surah Al-Baqarah, that oh children, do not die except
Being
as a Muslim, okay, as Muslims.
Yes.
This is important, guys. This is not very, very much difficult to be a Muslim. Okay, we are Muslims. The difficult thing is to stay being Muslim, stay being believers. This is very much important. Allah Almighty says in the next ayah, وَعَتَصِمُوا بِحَبْلِ اللَّهِ جَمِيعًا. Hold fast all together to Allah's cord. حَبْلِ اللَّهِ, in a hadith we have, this is Imam of time. This is Imam of the time for anyone. In the time of after the Prophet, in the time of Prophet, it was Prophet. In the time of it's Islam, Prophet, the book Quran, okay? So the Prophet is of course there, okay? So Hablillah, the cord or the rope of Allah, you know? The rope of Allah. وَعْتَصِمُوا بِحَبْلِ اللَّهِ جَمِيعًا. You all have to, okay? What? Hold fast this Habl. In a hadith, Imam Ali alayhi salam is the Hablillah al-Mateen.
Yes.
وَصُرَاتَهُ الْمُسْتَقِيمِ.
Yeah.
In Dua Nudba as well, we have this, yes? It's taken from the Quran. وَعَتَسِمُوا بِحَبْلِ اللَّهِ جَمِيعًا وَلَا تَفَرَّقُوا. This is very important. Unity between Muslims is very much important. It's very much important. If the people listen to the religion, it's okay, good. There will be no kind of misbehaviors, no, inshallah, no problems. But if the people do not listen to the prophets, do not follow the prophets, okay, it's better to keep them united instead of keeping them apart. So Allah Almighty says, وَعْتَصِمُوا بِحَبْلِ اللَّهِ جَمِيعًا وَلَا تَفَرَّقُوا and وَذْكُرُوا نِعْمَةَ اللَّهِ عَلَيْكُمْ. That the ayah continues and the explanation is too much. I just read the translation to you, okay? Then inshallah you can refer to the tafsir books.
قرآني في قلبي دوما يغمرني من فيض ضياء آيات
IRIB English Radio, in cooperation with Xavier International Schools, presents Let's recite the Quran.
Now we will mention some of the important tajweed rules, then shall we practice, all right?
Okay,
yes. Sir. Ya ayyuha alladhina amanu attaqullah. No special rule because we've mentioned all the mad, the dhal, these things in the previous sessions also. Ittaqullaha haqqa tuqatihi. Just remember the letter qaf is a heavy letter. Tuqatihi, that fallen ya. Here it's important. Wa la tamutunna. Noon mushaddad is important. Illa wa antum antum. Ikhfa, hide the sound of nun. Antum, mim. Muslimun, also mim mushaddad there, okay? Next ayah, wa'tasimu bihablillahi jami'an. Bihab, hablillah,
qalqala,
you bounce the sound. Lillahi, jami'an, tanween, plus waw, jami'aw. Wala tafarraqu. Yes, tafarraqu. Jim says, that is jayz, it's okay to stop or continue. وَذْكُرُوا نِعْمَةَ اللَّهِ عَلَيْكُمْ. There is no special rule, just the letter lam in the word Allah is pronounced heavily. نِعْمَةَ اللَّهِ عَلَيْكُمْ إِذْ كُنْتُمْ. Nun sakin, after nun sakin we have ta.
إِخْفَى,
hide the sound. كُنْتُمْ أَعْدَاءً, A'da'an. The mad is wajib here, Ali Nasir, yes? The alif mad and the hamza are in the same word. Yeah?
Yes. So actually, there are two ikhfa. In kuntum.
Kuntum. How?
Is no.
No, there's kuntum yeah, only.
It is sakin.
Yeah. Then, A'da'an fa'allafa, that's ikhfa, yes. A'da'an fa'allafa bayna qulubikum fa'asbahtum. Aha, tum, mim sakin. After mim sakin, ba.
Ikhfa.
Yeah, mim sakin plus ba, ikhfa of mim. Mim sakin, nun sakin plus ba, iqlab of nun. Which is also ikhfa of mim. We apply instead, yes? Instead of nun. فَأَصْبَحْتُمْ بِنِعْمَتِهِ. You can stretch this out. فَأَصْبَحْتُمْ بِنِعْمَتِهِ إِخْوَانَا. If you stop, tanween is changed to alif mat. إِخْوَانَا وَكُنْتُمْ. Tanween plus waw, idgham, merge the sounds. كُنْتُمْ إِخْفَى, the same as أَنْتُمْ. عَلَى شَفَى حُفْرَاتٍ. إِدْغَامْ again. مِنَ النَّارِ. إِدْغَامْ again. فَأَنْقَضَكُمْ. إِخْفَى again. Hide the sound of نون. مِنْهَا. نون ساكين. هَا. إِظْهَار. Pronounce the نون. كَذَلِكَ. Aha. قِلَى tells you it's better to stop. But you still can continue reciting or joining the two parts of the here, the left and right. كَذَلِكَ. يُبَيِّنُ اللَّهُ لَكُمْ آيَاتِهِ. The following ya is there. لَعَلَّكُمْ تَهْتَدُونَ. عَيْن, لَام, ذَال. These letters are important. حَا. Make sure you pronounce them correctly. Yeah. Let's, 1 minute we got. And the last minute in this session, we will practice the recitation now that we have learned the teaching rules. Ready?
Yes.
أَعُوذُ بِاللَّهِ مِنَ الشَّيْطَانِ الرَّجِيمِ.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا اتقوا الله حق تقاته ولا تموتن إلا وأنتم مسلمون.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا اتقوا الله حق تقاته ولا تموتن إلا وأنتم مسلمون.
واعتصموا بحبل الله جميعا ولا تفرقوا.
واعتصموا بحبل الله جميعا ولا تفرقوا.
واذكروا نعمة الله عليكم إذ كنتم أعداء فألف بين قلوبكم فأصبحتم بنعمته إخوانا.
واذكروا نعمة الله عليكم إذ كنتم أعداء فألف بين قلوبكم.
أحسن, that's good. فألف بين قلوبكم فأصبحتم بنعمته إخوانا.
فألف بين قلوبكم فأصبحتم بنعمته إخوانا.
فأصبحتم بنعمته إخوانا وكنتم على شفا حفرة من النار فأنقذكم منها.
فأصبحتم بنعمته إخوانا وكنتم على شفا حفرة من النار فأنقذكم منها.
أحسنت, ما شاء الله حسين, الله bless you, inshallah. The only one who goes till the end, that's great. كذلك يبين الله لكم آياته لعلكم تهتدون.
كذلك يبين الله لكم آياته لعلكم تهتدون
صدق الله العلي العظيم
صدق الله العلي العظيم
Santa mashallah, Allah bless you. Thank you so much, brothers and sisters. Alhamdulillah, we explained a bit about this ayah. And then we mentioned the important tajweed rules. We practiced the recitation. That's all from us for today. Inshallah, we'll be here with you in the coming sessions. Stay with IRB English Radio. Thank you so much for being with us up to this time. Brothers here, Fawad, Hassan, Hussein, Ali, Nasir. And inshallah, we'll be here again with you. See you. Walhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. وصلى الله على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين
اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم
Let's recite the Quran, a joint production of IRIB English Radio and Xavier International Schools.
نبع الهدى نلقى الجنان بحبه لن تستقيم حياتنا إلا به هو القرآن والفرقان إليه تنصت الأكوان وفيه تعطر الآذان والقرآن
The Prime Minister. Part 3.
In the mid-20th century, British and American diplomats traveling to Iran to negotiate oil deals were advised to view Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. Viewing Alice's Adventures in Wonderland was regarded as the best way for the foreigners to gain insight on Iran and its politicians. But for the Westerners, this man remained to be the most enigmatic politician of his era. What made Mohammad Mossadegh the greatest politician of his time? What decisions did he make? And what became of him at the end? The bloodiest war in human history has ended. The Second World War's uninvited guests should be leaving the country. However, before they leave Iran, they want to make sure the great treasures beneath the land would be safely taken care of by their elements. The rights to discover, excavate, refine, and export oil belongs exclusively to Britain. They were plundering Iran's vast oil reserves. The U.S. president responded to the Iranian prime minister's request for aid, promising to send his special representative to Iran. Dr. Mossadegh is happy with this response. Avril Harriman, the U.S. President's special representative, arrives in Tehran leading a team of negotiators.
Mr. Harriman, who was welcomed by the American ambassador, is used to these special missions, many of which he carried out for President Roosevelt.
Mossadegh, who was wary of the plots by the British government, wraps up the business at UN headquarters in New York and heads to Washington, D.C., to hold talks with U.S. officials to gain their support. Mossadegh meets with U.S. President Harry S. Truman. He asks Truman to help the Iranian nation fight against the economic sanctions slapped on them by the British government.
Our distinguished guest for this evening is Dr. Lyle J. Hayden.
How important is Iran to the West in that case?
Well, I consider it is very important because there is a great reserve of oil in that area, and we are interested in the oil reserves. And if Iran should go through a revolution, if some foreign power should take over control of Iran, it's quite conceivable that they could easily take over control of all the rest of the oil-producing area around the Persian Gulf. And that area produces or has as potential reserve some 40 or 60% of the world's reserve oil supply.
Which might be needed sometime.
Which might be needed sometime indeed.
On his route back from the United States, Mossadegh went on to visit Cairo at the invitation of Nahas Pasha, the Egyptian premier at the time. The visit is interpreted as a warning to the United Kingdom. The Egyptians, who want to nationalize the Suez Canal, see Iran as an admirable role model of resistance to emulate in order to restore their rights and obtain their national interests. The Prime Minister returns to Tehran and instructs the administration to launch its second mission, holding free and fair elections. Elections get underway for choosing lawmakers for the 17th session of the Majlis. The masses show great eagerness in these elections, hoping to see a structurally different kind of Majlis this time. They expect to see an independent Majlis which is neither influenced by the Shah's court nor foreign powers. However, before the voting process is completed across the country, the Prime Minister orders it to stop. Holding general elections for the 17th Majlis, as Mossadegh had promised, was never actualized. Reports coming out from here and there show that only a few pro-Mossadegh candidates had gained way into the Majlis as representatives of the people. Ayatollah Kashani and Dr. Mossadegh had different viewpoints on holding the elections, which led to a dispute and separation between them. Right after the new Majlis started its work, the lawmakers started visiting and holding meetings with the Americans and the British. The new Majlis spokesman, who is a pro-monarchy court agent, promotes Ghavam as the key person who could resolve the oil crisis. Also, the U.S. ambassador, after meeting Ghavam, sees him as the best substitute for Mossadegh. Britain supports Ghavam as well. The British ambassador goes to the Shah to convince him that it is time to remove Mossadegh. The Shah is looking for an excuse to justify Mossadegh's removal from the post, and very soon he finds that excuse. Mossadegh wants control over the armed forces to be in the hands of the government, not the Shah. However, the Shah knows that the armed forces are the source of his power over the nation. The Shah dismisses Mossadegh's request right away. No one could guess that Mossadegh's resignation would have serious repercussions. Ghavam proposes an immediate resumption of the Iran-Britain oil negotiations. Both Britain and the United States agree to this request. However, this was not the dream that the nation, that had suffered years of hardship, had in mind. In the morning, the situation is calm and quiet on July 21, 1952. Almost all government offices, retail centers, shops and factories are closed. Even buses and taxis have stopped work. In response to Ayatollah Kashani's call, people from all walks of society, shopkeepers, bazaar merchants, even members, supporters and sympathizers of the leftist Tudeh party, take to the streets, forming groups that take part in protest rallies. For 5 hours, the capital was in chaos. People chanted, "Down with Ghavam," and "Long live Mossadegh." After obtaining the Shah's approval, Ghavam begins to crack down on the protesters. The power to appoint the war minister and the armed forces chief of staff, which was the highest-ranking military authority in the country, was given to Mossadegh. And for the first time, the connection between the military and the Pahlavi dynasty was cut. On the day after the July 21st uprising, the Hague International Tribunal issued its final verdict in accordance to what Iran had stated. It announced that judging the Iran-Britain oil dispute was outside the court's jurisdiction. Mossadegh, who now had two huge victories under his belt, the Hague verdict and the July 21st uprising, resumed his nationalist efforts with new vigor. At this time, Mossadegh deals a series of serious blows to the Shah. He slashes both the budgets of the army and royal court. More than 100 senior officers are forced to resign. He orders the closure of the Senate and forces the Shah's twin sister, who was plotting against him, to go to a foreign country into exile. And as a last blow, Mossadegh continues his unending effort to gain clout. The extended powers Mossadegh sought included the power to change or devise new laws without needing to gain the Majlis's approval. Ayatollah Kashani was strongly opposed to granting greater powers to the government. He saw this move as a violation of the Constitution. He saw it as some sort of a sign of dictatorship. Nevertheless, Majlis members eventually agreed to pass a bill extending powers to Mossadegh. The Americans, who had failed to break the will of the Iranian nation, offer Mossadegh lip service. The U.S. ambassador in Iran tells Mossadegh that the Americans were supporting him in many different ways. However, behind his back, the Americans and British have reached a joint agreement with one another that there is no lawful way to topple Prime Minister Mossadegh's administration. The July 21st uprising showed that Mossadegh's popularity and power base was largely dependent on the support he garnered from Ayatollah Kashani. The political clout Mossadegh had gained after the July 21st uprising was one side of the coin. The unfolding events on the other side of the coin would be as detrimental as poison. While Mossadegh was still waiting for the Americans to offer aid, President Truman's term expires. Truman not only refrained from giving the financial aid he had promised, but also slapped economic sanctions on Iran. Despite Truman's failure to honor the promise he had made to Mossadegh, the Iranian Prime Minister writes to his successor, Eisenhower. Mossadegh asks the new U.S. president to give Iran the financial aid pledged by his predecessor, or at least lift the sanctions slapped on the Iranian nation. By the time Mossadegh receives the reply to his request, a plan for a coup d'etat against his democratically elected government had already been devised. The U.S. and Britain have wasted a lot of time waiting for the Shah and the Majlis to remove Mossadegh from power. After the July 21st incident, the two countries are sure that the only way to remove Mossadegh is through a coup. The two countries join forces to topple Mossadegh's nationalist government. The most important part of the plan is to create an agency to gather accurate information regarding the domestic situation and events and guide the political trends in the direction they favor.
IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.